You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Tuesday, 28 September. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb studios in Houghton, Johannesburg. On the show today, chatting with Gary Boyson. I want to know what's happening with oil. $80 for Brent oil. That's looking spooky. Peter Little from Anchor Capital. China and luxury. China is a huge part of luxury. How's that going to play out? And then Marius Reitz from Luno. Again, China cracking down on crypto, particularly the miners. That used to be a giant mining destination. What are the issues there? The show is brought to you by Stanlib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. Morning headlines from MoneyWeb. Tourism sector lost $164 billion in spending during 2020 and lost close to a million jobs over the last 3 years. Business Day, bonds hit by sell-off as inflation fears spook investors. Yields on our 10-year at highest levels since May. It's only 4 months ago, but it's certainly moving in the wrong direction. Overnight markets, we saw the US was red, S&P off a third, NASDAQ down 0.8%. Asia's red with Sydney down 0.9% and Tokyo off a third. Commodities mixed, gold 17.51, Brent 80.11 cents a barrel, Rand 14.97, went through 15 yesterday, back a bit today. Top 40, green open, about 100 points up at 0.15%, 10 cent during Hong Kong lunch, 1.8% higher.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Gary Boyson. He, of course, from Rand Swiss. Gary, appreciate the early morning. Looking at oil, I mean, I remember when it went through 60, and I thought 60 is probably about a level to settle. Went through 70. Now we've got Brent sitting at 80. A report out yesterday, well, I think it was JP Morgan, saying actually they think 90 is on the cards. What's happening with oil?
Yeah, it's impressive how the run has gone. I mean, just it feels like just yesterday we could get paid to take oil.
I remember that.
As you mentioned, so as first big kind of world news yesterday was that report was actually from Goldman Sachs forecasting $90 a barrel, and just again being very constructive around basically the increase in demand and the lack of supply. So oil is just a commodity, so that supply and demand curve has to play out. Now on the one hand, you've got if you look at the oil inventory drawdowns, that's been a lot more aggressive than people have thought previously. But at the same time, the supply just isn't coming on stream as quickly as it used to. And, there's a couple of reasons for that. So one, there is a structural change to the way that the oil markets are working, because everyone is, Sasol, for example, targeting, neutral carbon emissions by 2050. Mm-hmm. That is changing, and there's a huge underinvestment in oil. I mean, I remember watching ExxonMobil's results presentation, towards the end of last year, and they just making the case that oil has to go higher because there just aren't enough wells being sunk. It's just there's going to be a supply crunch, which seems to now be playing out. Again, you've also got the planning that these oil companies have had to do, which has been disrupted by COVID. It's been very difficult for them to know how fast demand was going to bounce back and how much oil to release into the market. And then, of course, we've got natural disasters like Hurricane Ida also taking some of the U.S. supply out of the market. So it's been a difficult time for oil producers, and one of the reasons that I think the price is a little bit more volatile.
In the olden days, Sasol was then the trade here. Oil at this price, they would be making booming profits. Sasol, of course, they're no longer the oil business. The Lake Charles has shifted that. But is there still a possible trade here in Sasol, which is doing well? Or is it a pure play offshore like an Exxon or a BP?
There's many ways to play oil these days. So I think, in years past, South African retail investors certainly were very limited to trading Sasol as a proxy for oil prices. And I've actually just run a correlation of the Rand oil price versus Sasol, and it's still incredibly correlated, even though, as you say, it's transitioning far more towards a chemical future and also to a more carbon neutral future. So those old, kind of gas to liquids and coal to liquids projects, so that kind of technology, perhaps going to be a bit less relevant in future. But you know, if you're just a stock trader and you're looking at the price action on Sasol compared to the price action in oil, it is a way to express the view. There's no question about that. You know, of course, like I said, in years past, it was the only way. But now, you know, South African retail investors have a huge swath of products to trade. So you can go into the underlying companies, you know, Exxon, Schlumberger, all sorts of, you know, BP, Royal Dutch Shell, there's plenty. Or you can just go and trade, you know, an ETF directly, something like USO, which will just give you essentially direct exposure, ungeared, but direct exposure to the oil price. And then, of course, you've got all the futures and CFD contracts as well. So very easy to express a view in oil these days.
Yeah, I take your point. Back in the day, it was just Sasol. There's also the Standard Bank one, the SB oil, which is a tracking brand. Quick last question. Is this a worry for inflation as well?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that. So I think it's one of the reasons that we're seeing the sell-off in the markets that we're seeing today. Obviously, we've got, you know, Evergrande, that ongoing debacle, you know, but a lot of the high oil prices, I think, are feeding expectations is that the Fed is going to need to taper sooner rather than later. I mean, we obviously had that FOMC meeting last week, which originally seemed fairly balanced, but the market seems to have interpreted as fairly hawkish. And if oil prices keep recovering, there's no question that inflation expectations are going to have to be adjusted, and the idea that we're just going to have a transitory period of high inflation goes out the window, because it will certainly feed into consumer prices.
Yeah, it goes out the window, the operative word there perhaps. Gary Boyson, Rand Swiss, appreciate the early morning.
We all have different investment needs. Some of us want to preserve our money for retirement, and others to create wealth for the next generation. At Stanlib, we have a team of investment specialists that can help you achieve any investment goal. So whether your money is looking for more certainty, more return, or more impact through your investments, we have a solution for your investment needs, no matter the time horizon. Join us over the next few months as we provide insights into the solutions we offer to meet your money needs. To find out more, visit stanlib.com or speak to your financial advisor. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. License number 719.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting now with Peter Little, investment analyst at Anchor Capital. Peter, appreciate the early morning. A note you put out just last week on luxury and China. And right up top, there's a chart that absolutely blew me away. I knew China was important. But I mean, if you look at the different companies, I mean, Swatch, 50% of sales, China down to LVMH at the bottom end, it's still 31%. The average is 35%. Richemont is 40%. Luxury is hugely dependent on the Chinese economy for future growth.
Yeah, absolutely, Sam. Thanks for having me this morning. So that's why the stocks reacted so badly to Xi Jinping's comments sort of mid-August when they were set to roll out these common prosperity goals, that there was a need to potentially reasonably regulate excessively high incomes, and all of these stocks came off sort of 15%, which people worried that Chinese luxury goods buyers would be disappearing. So clearly it's a significant region for them and likely to become increasingly more significant.
Yeah, I want to touch on that more significant. You certainly, the longer term view, or the medium to long term, is certainly positive. And in the short term, there is, you mentioned that, concerns around conspicuous consumption. Don't be flashing your Gucci bag and the like. And also potentially taxes coming. There will be some headwinds in China over potentially the next a couple of years, which will create some challenges for these luxury stocks.
Yeah, absolutely. I think certainly there's kind of regulation coming. I think China needs to reform its tax model, which is has a very low sort of personal income tax proportion. I think about 5% of China's taxes are from income tax. So they need to reform that. Their consumption taxes are heavily skewed towards import duties and duties on manufacturing, as opposed to sort of the VAT tax that you see in the rest of the world. So there's lots of these things coming, but obviously tax is a sensitive matter, and the Chinese Communist Party needs to ensure that it's alienated itself from the population. So I think these tax reforms will be rolled out slowly, but they're certainly more likely to impact the very high end of the spectrum in China going forward.
And then, I mean, the biggest story, perhaps, and this is, you know, the story of China to a degree. I mean, one of the things they're looking to do is double the middle income group over the next decade. That implies a growth of around 7% a year, and that's the group that's going to be out there in the future doing the shopping. So, sort of, once we're through perhaps the changes to the tax regimes and the like, there is actually a very bullish sort of medium to longer term story in luxury and in China in particular.
Exactly. So their goal to create an olive-shaped income distribution, which is kind of thick in the middle and skinny at the top and bottom, as opposed to the pyramid-shaped one they have now. At the moment, they have more than 50% of their population in that lower income group and just over 10% in the high income group. So the idea for them to create this olive shaped thing is actually just to shrink that or to move that low income group into the middle income area. So it's not so much about eradicating the high income group. They're happy for that to exist. It just can't get disproportionately big. But in the process of shifting these low income earners into the middle income, that's obviously, as you said, a huge boon for the middle income group. It should double over the next 10 years. Which is, as you say, about a 7% growth rate. And surveys done by Morgan Stanley and AlphaWise suggest that about 70% of the middle income cohort have made luxury goods purchases over the course of the last 24 months, which is, you know, if you look at the higher income groups, that number is sort of in the teens. So it's much more, luxury goods purchases are much more prevalent in that middle income group. And so, growing that middle income group in China is a sort of pretty powerful structural tailwind for luxury good purchases.
Yeah, 70% is a staggering number. A last point, you also suggest that perhaps a trend of more the soft luxury, and that's leather goods, that's fashions, perhaps growing a little faster than the sort of watches and jewelry. That's a trend that we've seen, and you think will potentially continue, and that plays into the LVMH, the Hermes, and the like.
Yeah, exactly. Certainly that's, the whole category's been going pretty fast. The sector that's probably struggled the most is the luxury watches, which obviously Richemont is pretty exposed to that. Swatches, obviously, that's pretty much all of their income. And since the corruption crackdown in China in was about 2015, that sector's been under huge pressure. Even within Richemont, you've seen their margins go sort of from operating margins of 15 to 20%, they're right down to kind of 5% now because the volumes just aren't there. So that's the one sector that struggled quite a lot. Richemont's latest results show that jewelry Maison was doing pretty well. So that part of hard luxury is doing okay. The watches not so much. But certainly the higher margins and the higher growth has been coming from that soft luxury portion.
We'll leave it there. That's Peter Little, investment analyst, Anchor Capital. As I said, a really, really great note put out last week. You'll find it on their website. Our question today, which we are asking on our Twitter and LinkedIn, is luxury an asset class that you're particularly looking into investing, particularly chatting with Peter there for the longer term, that growth potential in China? You can have your say. You can have your vote on our LinkedIn and Twitter profiles.
We all have different investment needs. Some of us want to preserve our money for retirement, and others to create wealth for the next generation. At Stanlib, we have a team of investment specialists that can help you achieve any investment goal. So whether your money is looking for more certainty, more return, or more impact through your investments, we have a solution for your investment needs, no matter the time horizon. Join us over the next few months as we provide insights into the solutions we offer to meet your money needs. To find out more, visit stanlib.com or speak to your financial advisor. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. License number 719.
Business, finance, and investment news. MoneyWeb Now
with Simon Brown.
On the Money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Marius Raitz. He's the general manager for Africa at Luno, and obviously a local crypto exchange. Marius, appreciate the early morning. We saw last week a crackdown from China on crypto, and not the first crackdown. They did it a couple of years ago. They seem to be sort of turning the screws a little bit more. This very much in line with what we've seen in sort of coming out of China around, you know, trying to protect the population and the like. And, you know, we've seen it in education stocks, we've seen it in gaming for kids. How significant is China in the crypto world? I mean, the initial response was selling in the cryptos. Is it that important?
Morning, Simon. Yes, as you say, look, I think China has banned crypto close to 5 or 6 times now, so it's really nothing new. We see the same happening in countries like Nigeria. It happens all the time, and it never really impacts the market in the larger scheme of things. So each time, it's typically followed by some market volatility. Last week, the Bitcoin price fell, I think, just over 4%. Mm-hmm. It's recovered most of it already. So these bans, started as early as 2013, banning financial institutions from banking cryptocurrency platforms. Then it shut down exchanges and then banned ICOs. And earlier in the year, of course, they banned crypto mining. And now this renewed announcement. So as you say, Bitcoin is a risk asset. People trade the news. The majority of crypto trading happens during US and EU trading hours, really. So the impact of this announcement will just lead, just lead to some volatility in those markets. And most of the trading in China at this point happens through USDT and USDC, which are two stable coins. So the Chinese yuan and Bitcoin trading pairs have shifted out of the market years ago already. So, but as you say, the overall fintech climate in China is shifting, as we've seen with Alibaba. Mm-hmm. And it'll be interesting to see where this ends up. But the interesting thing, Simon, is that as you know, it's very difficult to really ban crypto.
Well, yeah.
You only need an internet connection. And then we see growth happening from a grassroots level up. So people will always find a way to access cryptocurrency if it provides some of that better alternative or that higher yield compared to local currencies or other assets.
Yeah. And of course, China did not ban their own central bank crypto coin, which they've been trialing and slowly rolling out. You mentioned the banning of miners. I mean, there was a time when particularly in Bitcoin, the mining was all happening in China, but you ban it and it will shift to other markets. I mean, the crypto will find a way. It's like water finding its way down to the coast.
Absolutely. China owned had a 75% share of the global Bitcoin hash rate, which is the mining power. Mm-hmm. Previously, but that declined from 75% in 2019 to 46% in April this year. So Chinese miners and the equipment were already on the move by the time of last week's ban. And we've seen the US's share of the total Bitcoin hash rate increase to from 4% to almost 17%. Interestingly enough, Kazakhstan, a neighboring country, has also seen an increase because of the abundance in energy. And then, yes, crypto-friendly states such as Texas and Wyoming in the US, they've got a very pro-crypto governor in Texas, and countries such as Norway with ample renewable energy sources, they are the big benefactors of China's ban. So miners elsewhere now just have a bigger share of the global Bitcoin mining pie, and that together with rising Bitcoin prices have seen these miners' profits skyrocket over the last couple of months. So
A quick last question. I mean, China banning this. I mean, I see, a lot of folks I know, particularly, in the US and the like, in the olden days, they wanted to work in banking. Now they want to work in crypto, blockchain, all the different things. This kind of almost puts China on the back foot going forward from a technological perspective, because they're not going to be having their own populist sort of, innovating within the broader crypto/blockchain space.
Yeah, for sure. I think most of the cryptocurrency expertise and platforms and companies innovating in this space have really moved out of the market, and they've established themselves in countries such as Singapore and Hong Kong. So we've already seen a lot of talent, the talent pool in the market, becoming smaller and smaller. So I'm not sure what impact the digital yuan, the digital currency project, the central bank digital currency project will have, and whether, they're employing most of the expertise now, nowadays. But, it's interesting and it's a global trend, really. We've seen at Lino as well. We've seen a lot of young people, a lot of, finance and legal experts moving to the crypto markets, moving to the blockchain companies. So, that's definitely a shift that's happening.
And that's a good point. It's not just the sort of coders. It's finance. It's legal for those bits as well. Marius Reitz, General Manager for Africa at Luno. Appreciate the early morning. That's it for today. Our poll we asked you yesterday in our LinkedIn and Twitter accounts. We're chatting with Dr. Adrian Saville there around inflation, but also the governor talking around a lower inflation target. 2-4% is what he wants to move it down to. Maybe not in one big step. Adrian pointed out that there's going to be a lot of pushback from Labour, from political parties. We asked you your thoughts on it. Almost half of you said, yeah, you think that's a great idea. A quarter of you were worried that that would push rates up in the short term. And absolutely right on that. The other quarter of you think that your inflation rate is way higher already, and this is all just moot. The show is brought to you by Stanlib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website's in the app, 6:30 a.m. Podcast available just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie and Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their early morning contributions. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.